Chapter 36. After their fourth submerged interval, Dirk and Summer reunited on the surface and took a moment to rest. Fighting their way across the current, they had distanced themselves from the skiff by almost 400 meters. "We can swim on the surface for the time being," Dirk said between deep breaths. "Give us a chance to see what our friends are up to." Summer followed her brother's lead and rolled onto her back, kicking into a backstroke that allowed them to watch the distant catamaran as they moved further across the river. Kang's boat was idling near the skiff, its spotlights circling the immediate area around them. Shouting erupted from the catamaran, and the boat suddenly raced downriver a short distance. Gunfire exploded again for a moment, then ceased as the boat stopped in the water. Tongju had raced the catamaran towards the two objects spotted floating on the water and watched with disdain as his gunmen blasted away at the empty life vests that Dirk had tossed into the water. The boat idled around the life jackets for several minutes, waiting for the two escapees to surface in case they were hiding submerged nearby, before resuming the search. Dirk and Summer struggled towards mid-river as they watched the catamaran begin making a wide circle search around the skiff and life jackets. With each loop around the still drifting skiff, the catamaran's pilot enlarged the circle in an ever-expanding spiral. "Won't be too many more minutes before they work their way up and out our direction," Summer lamented. Dirk scanned the watery horizon. They had worked their way about a mile into the river, but were still barely a quarter of the way across the vast waterway. They could turn back and try for the nearest shoreline, but that would entail crossing the path of the advancing catamaran. Or they could continue with their original plan of traversing the river towards the lights on the opposite shore. But fatigue was beginning to creep up on them, hastened by their long immersion in the cool water. Another 3-mile swim would be a tall order, made more difficult by the repeated submergings they would have to perform to avoid Kang's boat. Whether they could, in fact, survive the game of cat and mouse with Tongju and his gunmen would be uncertain at best. But there was a third option. The small vessel with the colored lights that they had earlier noticed upriver was approaching on a nearby path about a 0.5 mile away. In the darkness, Dirk had trouble identifying the boat, but it appeared to be a wooden sailing vessel of some kind. A small red sail, revealed under the white mast light to be square-shaped in dimension, was raised near the bow, but the boat didn't appear to be moving much faster than the current. Dirk gauged the path of the boat and swam another 100 yards towards the center of the river, then stopped. Summer swam past before realizing her brother had halted.
"What gives? We need to keep going," she whispered after swimming back to him.
Dirk nodded downriver towards the catamaran. The sleek vessel had arced well out into the river as it circled downstream. He mentally calculated the trajectory of the yacht if it held its current circular course. "They'll be within sight of us on the next upriver pass," he said quietly. Summer could see he was right. The bright beams of the searchlights would shine upon their position on the next loop. They would have to remain submerged for several minutes to guarantee their concealment. Dirk took a quick glance upriver.
"Sister, I think it's time for Plan B."
"Plan B?" she asked.
"Yes, Plan B. Stick out your thumb and start hitchhiking."
The large wooden sailboat creaked lazily down the river, its foremast sail and a small auxiliary motor pushing it along just 3 knots faster than the current. As the vessel crept closer, Dirk could see that it was a 3-masted Chinese junk of about 25 meters in length. Unlike most dilapidated sailing boats in this part of the world, the junk appeared to be maintained in pristine condition. A string of multicolored Chinese lanterns hung gaily from bow to stern, lending a party-like atmosphere to the boat. Constructed entirely of rich teak wood, the highly varnished surfaces seemed to glisten under the swaying overhead lamps. Somewhere below deck, a pair of stereo speakers blared out an orchestral tune, which Dirk recognized as a Gershwin melody. Yet despite the festive atmosphere, there was not a soul to be seen on deck.
"Ahoy! We're in the water! Can you help?"
Dirk's muted shout went unanswered as the junk approached.
He repeated the call, careful not to draw attention from the catamaran, which had completed a downstream turn and was now headed upriver. Swimming closer to the moving junk, Dirk thought he detected a shadowy movement on the stern, but again, there was no response to his call for help. He tried a third time, failing to notice as he spoke that the muffled drone of the junk's motor audibly raised a note. The junk's golden teak hull began gliding past Dirk and Summer, an ornately carved dragon on the prow eyeing them maliciously in the water less than 10 feet from the starboard beam. Like a phantom in the night, the junk slipped by, strangely impervious to the voices calling from the water. As the stern and rudder post floated past, Dirk abandoned hope of rescue from the junk and angrily wondered whether the pilot was asleep, drunk, or both. Peering towards the slowly approaching catamaran, he was startled by a sudden splash in the water near his head. It was an orange plastic float tied to a coil of rope, trailing back to the stern of the junk. "Grab hold and hang on tight," he instructed his sister, making sure Summer had a strong grip on the line before grasping it himself. As the line quickly drew taut, the force of the junk sailing faster than the river momentarily jerked them underwater. With a face full of water, they were dragged along the river's surface like a fallen water skier who forgot to let go of the tow line. Dirk slowly began pulling himself up the line hand over hand as his legs flailed out behind him. Reaching the high, blunt stern of the junk, he shimmied up the rope almost vertically until reaching the stern railing. A pair of hands emerged from the darkness, grabbing about his lapels and forcefully yanking him over the railing and onto the deck. "Thanks," Dirk muttered, paying little heed to a tall figure in the shadows. "My sister is still on the line," he gasped, standing and grabbing the line at the stern rail and pulling at it. The tall man stepped up behind him and clasped the line, throwing his weight into it with Dirk. Together, they hoisted Summer up the railing like a gigged flounder until she flopped over the railing and onto the deck in a soggy heap. A high-pitched bark erupted from across the deck, and in an instant, a small, black-and-tan dachshund raced over to Summer and began licking her face. "Dark night for a swim, don't you think?" the stranger said in English. "You're American," Dirk stated with surprise. "Ever since being born in the land of Lincoln," came the reply. Dirk studied the man beside him for the first time. He stood 6'3", nearly matching his own height, though he carried a good 20 pounds more heft. A wave of unruly white hair and a matching goatee indicated that he was at least 40 years his senior. The man's blue-green eyes, which seemed to twinkle with mischief under the hanging lights, touched a nerve with him. He felt as if he was looking at an older version of his own father, he finally decided. "We're in great danger," Summer injected, rising to her feet. She scooped up the small dog as she stood and rubbed its ears briskly, which produced a sharp wag of its tail. "Our research vessel was sunk by these murderers, and they mean to kill us," she said, nodding downriver towards the catamaran that was circling slowly in their direction. "I heard the machine gun fire," the man replied. "They intend to make another deadly attack. We need to alert the authorities," she pleaded. "Thousands of additional lives are at risk," Dirk added somberly. The white-haired man perused the odd pair up and down. Summer, soaked but elegant still in her ripped silk cocktail dress, appeared an unusual companion for Dirk, who was battered and bruised in a shredded blue jumpsuit. Neither attempted to conceal the handcuffed shackles that dangled from their wrists. A slight grin fell across the man's lips. "I guess I'll buy it. We better hide you below deck until we get past that cat. You can stay in Mauser's cabin." "Mauser? How many people are aboard?" Dirk asked. "Just me and that fellow who's kissing your sister," he replied. Dirk turned to see the small dachshund happily licking the water off Summer's face. The junk's owner quickly led them through a bulkhead door and down a flight of steps that led to a tastefully decorated stateroom. "There's towels in the bath and dry clothes in the closet. And here, this will warm you up." He grabbed a bottle sitting on a side table and poured them each a glass of the clear fluid. Dirk downed a shot quickly, tasting a bitter flavor from the smooth liquor that clearly packed a high alcohol content. "Soju," the man said. "A local rice brew. Help yourself while I try to get us past your friends and the cat." "Thank you for helping us," Summer replied appreciatively. By the way, my name is Summer Pitt, and this is my brother Dirk. Pleased to meet you. My name is Clive Cussler. Cussler returned to the junk's exposed wheel and slipped the engine into gear, tweaking the throttle slightly higher while nosing the bow further towards mid-river. It took only a few minutes before the catamaran approached from downstream, pulling alongside and washing the junk in a flood of spotlights. Cussler slipped on a conical straw peasant's hat and hunched his tall frame low at the wheel. Through the glare of the lights, he could see several men pointing automatic weapons at him. As the catamaran crept to within inches of the port beam, an unseen man on the bridge barked a question across through the boat's PA system. Cussler replied by shaking his head. Another command echoed across from the catamaran as the spotlights bounced about the junk. Cussler again shook his head, wondering whether the waterlogged coil of rope and wet pairs of footprints across the deck would be detected. For several long minutes, the catamaran held steady at the junk's side, as if waiting to board. Then, with a sudden blast of its engines, the catamaran roared away, resuming its river search closer to shore. Cussler guided the junk down the last vestiges of the Han River until its waters were swallowed by the Yellow Sea. As the sea lanes opened and the potential for nearby water traffic fell away, Cussler punched a handful of electronic controls at the helm. Hydraulic winches began to whir as lines were pulled and yards were raised, pulling the traditional red square-shaped lug sails of a classic junk to the peak of the main and mizzen masts. Cussler manually tied off the outhaul lines and then powered off the small diesel motor. The old junk now leapt through the waves under the graceful power of its sails. "You've got a beautiful vessel," Dirk said, emerging from below decks, dressed in jeans and a polo shirt. Summer followed him onto the deck, clad in an oversized pair of coveralls and a man's work shirt. "The standard Chinese merchant ship that dates back almost 2,000 years," Cussler replied. "This one was built in Shanghai in 1907 for a wealthy tea trader. She's made entirely from a hard teak wood called Takyan Tong. She's extremely durable and surprisingly seaworthy." "Where did you find her?" Summer asked. "A friend of mine found her abandoned in a Malaysian boatyard and decided to refurbish her. Took him 6 years to complete the job. After he grew bored with sailing, I traded him a few antique cars for her. Planned to cruise the Asian Pacific in her. Started in Japan and am going to work my way down to Wellington."
"You sail her by yourself?" Summer asked.
"She's been modified with a strong diesel engine and hydraulic lifts for the lug sails, which are linked to a computerized automatic pilot. She's a breeze to manage and can, in fact, sail herself."
"Do you have a satellite phone aboard?" Dirk asked.
"Afraid not. A ship-to-shore radio is the best I can offer you. I didn't want any phone calls or internet messages bothering me on this cruise."
"Understandable.
Where are you headed, and, for that matter, where are we located now?" he asked. Cussler pulled out a marine navigation chart and held it under the weak light of the helm console. "We're entering the Yellow Sea about 40 miles northwest of Seoul."
"I take it you aren't interested in staying aboard till Wellington?" he grinned, running an index finger across the chart.
"How about Incheon?" he continued, tapping the map. "I can drop you there in about 8 hours. I believe there's a U.S. Air Force base located somewhere near there."
"That would be great. Anywhere we can find a phone and get a hold of someone at NUMA headquarters."
"NUMA," Cussler said, mulling over the word. "You're not from that NUMA ship that sank southwest of Japan."
"The Sea Rover."
"Yes, we are."
"How did you know about that?" Summer asked.
"It was all over CNN. I saw them interview the captain. Told how the crew was rescued by a Japanese freighter following an explosion in the engine room."
Dirk and Summer stared at each other in disbelief.
"Captain Morgan and the crew are alive?" she finally blurted.
"Yes, that was the fellow's name. I thought he said the whole crew was rescued."
Summer retold the story of their attack on the ship and abduction by Kang's men, and their uncertainty over the fate of their crew members.
"I suspect there's more than a few people out there looking for you," Cussler said. "You're safe for now.
There's some sandwiches and beer in the galley. Why don't you two grab a bite and get some rest? I'll wake you when we reach Inchon.
Thank you. I'll take you up on that, Summer replied, heading below deck.
Dirk lingered a moment, standing at the rail and watching the first glimmer of daybreak attempt to paint the eastern horizon. As he contemplated the events of the past 3 days, a hardened resolve surged through his exhausted body. By some miracle, the Sea Rover's crew had survived the sinking of the Numa research ship. But Kang still had blood on his hands, and the stakes were now dramatically higher. If what Kang had told them was true, then millions of lives were at risk. The madman would have to be stopped, he knew, and quick.